When I see the Apostle Paul's comment that some people make certain days special while others honor all days alike, I think of the early Congregationalists who were mostly in the second camp, honoring every day as sacred and ignoring most of the holidays that had come to crowd the Christian calendar. Except for Christmas and Easter, I generally follow their lead, but this morning finds me happy to surrender to what every restaurant and florist and greeting card company says should be on my mind. It's not a complete surrender, because instead of honoring only mothers this morning, I want to honor women in general. It has been 14 years since I last spoke at any length in the pulpit about women, and since then, certain convictions have gotten stronger because of what I've seen and read in the meantime, and most of all because of one particular woman with whom I have known more happiness than I deserve. So I'm ready to try that topic again. Today's sermon was chosen a couple of months ago while I was reading a chapter in a book called Pioneer Women, Voices from the Kansas Frontier. Far from towns, in a harsh and unforgiving wilderness, these women faced lonely lives with amazing strength and courage. Husbands often left for days or weeks at a time on trading or hunting expeditions. And even when they were at home, they worked land that might be too far out of range to respond to a call for help. Women faced special dangers during pregnancy and childbirth, and I thought of them the other day when I visited one of those high-tech birth suites at Wesley. In these days of proper diet and vitamin pills and frequent monitoring by a physician and delivery in a place with the technology for handling all sorts of emergencies, expectant mothers have so many advantages, it's hard for me to imagine the courage and resourcefulness of pioneer women 150 years ago on the Kansas prairie. The book I mentioned tells of one woman whose time came sooner than expected, an hour or so after her husband had left on an all-day wagon trip to get wood for the coming winter, alone with two babies, one 4 and the other 18 months, and with no neighbor or doctor to summon, she set out, bread and butter sandwiches and a pitcher of milk for the children, drew a bucket of fresh water from a 60-foot well, laid out scissors and clean towels beside the bed, and hoped the family dog understood when she told him to keep the babies inside and away from rattlesnakes in what passed for a yard. The baby arrived at noon. The mother fainted several times while trying to clean and wrap it. And when the father returned that night, he found everyone safe and well. But there were not always happy endings. Many pioneer wives, despite their courage, died young and were celebrated in no books. They deserved medals. It's a masterpiece of understatement to say that life through the centuries has not been kind to most women. Move backward in time from recent pictures of the Taliban beating women with clubs for accidentally showing an ankle, and ultra-Orthodox Jews throwing chairs at women who were attempting to pray at Jerusalem's Western Wall, back to an early church father describing Eve as the devil's gateway, the one who destroyed God's image, meaning man, of course, and the one whose sin caused the Son of God himself to have to die. Hear this complaint from a 5th century pope. We have heard, to our annoyance, that divine affairs have come to such a low state that women are encouraged to officiate at sacred altars. Read about a 6th century church council in France where 63 bishops once debated the question, are women human? And women managed to win humanity that day by a single vote. There was that crusty 16th century reformer named Martin Luther who delivered his august opinion that, quote, women should remain at home, sit still, keep house, and bear and bring up children. And listen to the great English poet John Milton, who, when he personifies sin in Paradise Lost, makes sin a woman, the daughter of Satan himself, and says of Adam's fall in the Garden of Eden that the same kind of thing will happen to any man who trusts women too much. No wonder women seldom had a chance to be more than useful household slaves through hundreds and hundreds of years. Most change for the better has come only recently. I grew up in a church so dominated by men that it would have been unthinkable to invite a woman to a meeting where church business would be discussed. I remember a Wednesday night when a woman in a Bible class was not allowed to get out of her seat and go to the blackboard to illustrate a point, even though she was a university professor and an expert on the topic under discussion. The elders, who were always male, ruled that she could speak only while seated. Otherwise, she could be seen as usurping authority from those whom God had put in charge. In that same church, two men of questionable musical talent took turns as song leaders. But what I remember best about them is that one day they were both so hoarse at the same time that neither one could warble a note. A woman named Nina Province had a magnificent voice, but they dared not invite her to usurp male authority by standing up to lead the congregation as they did. So, as literalists and legalists often do, they found a way around the dilemma. One of them stood up as if to direct, while Nina submissively sat in her third row pew and led the song. Male authority had been saved. I was still a teenager when that strange scene played itself out one Sunday evening, but those chauvinistic moments still happen. Not long ago, a church in Northwest Arkansas closed its daycare center because the church board declared that God wants women to stay at home. That decision left 27 children without any women to offer daycare, and state officials had to license another facility to take the place of the one at the First Baptist Church of Berryville. One more sad, silly little story in the history of male chauvinism and the amazing patience of women willing to accept such things as the will of God. The Bible has to bear blame for much of this nonsense, beginning with one of the creation stories in which woman is clearly derivative. Derivative, as in taken from. That is, according to the legend, taken from man's side, a story male Bible scholars would later expand by saying that Eve came from Adam's left side, because in so many languages, the word left is synonymous with weak or worthless. The examples of chauvinistic bias in both religious and secular history are far too numerous to cover in a single sermon, even in the three I devoted to that topic several years ago. But the good news is that even in the worst of times, some remarkable woman would stand the system on its head. Here is one such moment. A little over 300 years ago, on a June morning, in the Italian city of Padua, the first woman in the world to get a doctoral degree stood in a pulpit to be examined in the philosophy and rhetoric of Aristotle. Precociously brilliant, she had begun to study Aristotle at 7 and was capable in Latin, Greek, French, English, Spanish, Hebrew, Arabic, and Chaldaic by the time she enrolled in the University of Padua. She had wanted to take her doctorate in theology, but the head of that department, who was a bishop, said indignantly, "Never. Woman is meant for motherhood, not learning." And writing later about that request, he says, "I talked with a French cardinal about it, and he broke out in laughter." Reluctantly, since the prestige of the university was at stake, he finally allowed her to take the exam in philosophy. Her replies that day were so brilliant that the academic judges declared the doctorate in philosophy was hardly a sufficient honor for so towering an intellect. So she got the doctoral ring on her finger, the ermine cape of a teacher laid on her shoulders, and the laurel crown of a poet placed on her dark, curly head. The entire assembly rose and sang a Te Deum of praise to God. Well, unfortunately, moments like that were very rare. And equal opportunity for most women was still far in the future. When people ask me why I am a Congregationalist, one of the reasons I love to give them is that we ordained the first woman to ministry 150 years ago. Her name was Antoinette Brown, educated in theology at Oberlin, and installed as the pastor of a small congregational church in South Butler, New York. But hostility remains. As late as 1994, just before the Church of England ordained its first 33 women priests, an Anglican priest used an epithet too ugly to speak in a pulpit, and said such women should be burned at the stake like medieval witches. 1994. How strange that sounds now that we know how much the strengths and the skills of women have contributed to religion. Someone here spoke just the other day of reading the superb new biography of our second president, John Adams, who helped shape our system of democracy. There is also much in that book about his equally extraordinary wife, Abigail, daughter of a Congregational minister, who sent this avant-garde message to her husband. She said, "In the new code of laws, I desire you would remember the ladies and be more favorable to them. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of husbands." Other wives, as they have done from time immemorial, quietly made it possible for their husbands to succeed. When Nathaniel Hawthorne lost his job in the customs house, he went home brokenhearted to tell his wife, Sophia, that he was a failure. To his amazement, she smiled happily and said, "Now you can write your book." When he asked bitterly what they would live on while he wrote it, she opened a drawer and took out a hoard of cash. Hawthorne was astounded. "Where on earth did you get that?" "Well," she told him calmly, "I have always known you were a man of genius. I knew that someday you would write an immortal masterpiece, so every week, out of the housekeeping money, I have saved something. Here is enough to last us for one whole year." Which is why so many of you, at some time in your life, have read one of the best of early American novels, The Scarlet Letter. Other women, aware of public prejudice against their daring to compete with men in literature, simply wrote their own novels, but, shameful to be said, felt they had to do it under a male pseudonym. The brilliant Mary Ann Evans, for example, writing under the pen name of George Eliot, producing books like Silas Marner, Adam Bede, The Mill on the Floss. And when those three bright Bronte sisters, Charlotte, Emily, and Anne, first ventured into print with a book of their poetry, they thought it wise to hide their sex under the masculine names of three brothers named Bell. How sad to read of that cultural subterfuge from women whose genius would later give us Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights. During long centuries, with almost no professional competition from women, most men went blithely through life with little thought of how much women were damaged by a chauvinistic world. Who knows when they began to justify it through jokes, built around themes of male dominance. But once they discovered how much fun it was, the floodgates were open. "Why are women so much trouble?" they asked one another, and then created 1,000 jokes to explain it. One of them told his buddies at the local pub how Adam was feeling so lonely one day in the Garden of Eden that God wondered what was wrong. Adam said he didn't have anyone to talk to, so God promised a companion whose name would be Woman. God said, "This person will cook for you and wash your clothes and always agree with every decision you make. She will bear you children and never ask you to get up in the middle of the night to take care of them. She will not nag you, and she will always be the first to admit that she was wrong when the two of you have a disagreement." Adam could not imagine anything better than that. But one thing troubled him. How much, he asked God, will a woman like that cost? And according to the boys in the bar, History was forever changed when God said, an arm and a leg. And Adam asked, what could I get for just a rib? But there was always, because women are marvelously resilient, there was always some woman to remind her sisters of what they were worth, even when they had to live in the shadows of male dominance. Around the village well, out to lunch at Applebee's, over the internet, women survived by insider jokes of their own. They reminded one another that the difference between men and government bonds is that the bonds mature. Ask how many caring men in the world it takes to do the dishes. They answered, both of them. Or there would be one, like the quick-witted woman I know who has learned how to manage a frugal husband who grew up during the Great Depression. Just the other day, when she told him that she was going shopping, he reminded her that there was no more room in the closets and that she should probably just look instead of buying. A few hours later, she came home with a new dress. When he wondered what happened to just looking, she said, well, mostly I did just look. But when I saw this particular dress, I thought I'd try it on. And when I did, the devil whispered, it sure looks good on you. Her husband, who knew the Bible, said, well, right then you should have said, get thee behind me, Satan. Oh, I did, she said. But when he got behind me, he said, it sure looks good from the back, too. This is the same woman who believes in helping her husband laugh at himself when his ego threatens to go out of control. She was with him one day in Wichita when he decided to weigh himself on one of those scales that print out a little card with your fortune on it. While he looked at the pounds, she read the card to him. Well, listen to this. It says that you are a leader with a magnetic personality and a strong character, that you are generous, intelligent, witty, and attractive to the opposite sex. She let the smile spread across his face before she looked over at the numbers on the scale and said, I see it has your weight wrong, too. If you wonder how that particular man took those comebacks, I have it on the best of authority that he loved them. And that almost, though not entirely, they saved him from being a pompous fool. I know this because just the other day when he was looking at a poem by Carl Sandburg, he read two lines that summed up the ultimate necessity in his life. In the poet's words, if all else is lost, leave me a voice to speak to me in the day's end, a hand to touch me in the dark room. Well, I have expanded Mother's Day to include all women, but I've not forgotten those who are mothers, nor their sons and daughters who pay them honor this morning, which means I still have one piece of unfinished business. Your worship program says that the flowers on the communion table have been given for the pleasure of every person in this room, and in special honor of someone whose name is to be announced later. Now, it turns out, by the most striking coincidence, that I have been asked to read the card that came with those flowers. It says they have been sent in honor of our wonderful mother, for whose patient love and laughter we give thanks every day of our lives. And it's signed by a daughter named Karen Wakefield and by two sons named Robin and Devin Myers. Their wish and mine is that she and every mother and every woman in this room shall have a very happy day.